station promise outstanding content, but when it's time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to LATalkRadio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor.
Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor.
Another long holiday weekend is over, and you regale us with tales of woe. You did too much yard work, too many projects, too much running around, but you didn't get enough rest.
Gee, you never worked that hard around here.
Really, man, we don't care.
And need a break from your whining, yeah.
So the next time the martyr of the mini vacation shows up late and says, I need another long weekend to recover from my long weekend, don't strangle. Instead, salute Mr. 3-Day Weekend Survivor, a real American hero.
Mr. 3-Day Weekend Survivor.
No, it's not Friday yet, you slacker.
Get ready for the best morning show on any kind of radio. Broadcasting live from the palatial studios of LA Talk Radio. Get ready for Sam and Kara in the morning. Give Sam and Kara a call at 323-203-0815. And now, here are your hosts, Sam and Kara.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 2nd, a new week, a new month. We're starting our week on Wednesday, aren't we?
Oh, man, I'm so happy to be back.
Yeah.
A
4-day weekend we had, didn't we?
Yes, but yeah. this is where the magic starts, people. This is where it all...
This is where what starts?
This is where the magic starts, because we're flowing and doing what we love to do.
Mm-hmm.
I did a day yesterday of working in an office, long story. Not that long, but whatever.
In an office, you...
I know.
Oh my God!
It's actually some clients of a friend of mine that they request me. It's really not a big deal. It's not like they request me to be their filer, but it's kind of fun to go in there once in a while, make a little cash, and say hi to them and maintain contacts because they're quite.
So you've worked there before?
Yes, on and off.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Like once every few months or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, really great people. And I sit on my ass all day, and I'm on the computer, and I'm working or whatever, and I just literally answer phones.
Yeah.
You know? Thank you for calling. Okay, hold. You know, that's all I do.
Yeah.
All, I mean, nothing.
Sounds like fun.
I do nothing. So yeah. It's good to get, you know, a little cash and do nothing, right?
Yeah.
Well, then the one time, this has happened a couple times, but then in the middle of the day when I'm at like 6 hours of doing nothing,
mm-hmm.
they asked me to do something.
Yeah.
And that something involves about a 3 feet tall stack of papers that need to be Xerox copied into 3 different copies.
Oh my God.
And then they have to be labeled and divided and put hole punched and put in binders and then FedExed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's what they hired you for.
No, yeah. Not really. No. That's not really what they...
But you didn't do anything, so apparently they didn't need you other than for that.
No, it's just supposed to be a phone person, basically.
Right,
cover
okay.
the phones. But sometimes
they'll have... So in between calls, there's nothing to do.
Nothing. I mean, occasionally I'll file something, and it's... I mean, I do it. I don't throw an attitude. I mean, it's no mm-hmm. problem. I just know if you've got something that needs to be copied, anything that has to do with a copy machine, just don't involve me in that process. I'm trying to tell you it is... Not brain surgery, but it's right underneath it.
Yeah.
Xerox copy machines.
Really?
Yes. So I'm copying this huge, massive 5-pound stack of papers. Of course, it's got to get jammed a couple times. That's fine. That's normal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to run out of paper. I can handle that. Then, as I'm collating, what that means, collating, mm-hmm. whatever, I just found that out. It's when you're Xerox copying it and you have it go in different stacks or whatever.
Right.
It says, error, misfiled. Misfiled. And then it starts popping out all the originals. So I look at it, I'm trying to fix it, I think, oh, it looks like it's fixed. We continue with the 3 other million thousand papers I have to do, put them all in files. Well, then we're organizing the papers, and it's all wrong. I mean, and this thing has to go out like an hour.
Wow.
And the pressure's on, and then the office manager, she's real pissed at me, and she really likes me. The sad thing is that they really like me, and they're pissed off at me. That's worse. It's worse when people think you're awesome and love you, and then you just fall from that favor. And they turn, and they're so mad at you. And then she has to get the partner out, the lawyer.
She was mad at you?
Well, they're not mad at me, but they're like, yeah, they're mad at me in the moment.
Right.
And then the partner, the lawyer.
How terrible is that, huh? You're there one day.
One day, and I love going in because we say hi, we catch up. They're really great people. They're really big fans of me. They're so supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And then I screw it up. And then the partner comes out, who the head dude, who I really like. He's like, I don't understand. I had the original this here and this thing. Anyway, so he walks away and leaves it there, and I try to fix it, and I only mess it up worse.
Really?
I start having I'm literally like, my face is so red, and I'm like, I'm screwing this up. I almost said, okay, guys, I should just go home now.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I toughed it out, and we got through it. But it was just, it was like air traffic controller shit.
Oh, man.
I'm just saying.
What
this
an
is
exciting
where,
day.
I'm like, let organized people do their thing and be organized. Let creative people do their thing and be creative. Yeah, stretch yourself a bit.
Yeah, you were not that, made for that kind
hell
of work.
No, I'm not. So
you're a free spirit.
I'm so happy. I'm drinking a cheap mocha from McCafe.
Yeah.
McDonald's. McCafe.
So I mean, did at least did they pay you well at least for that time?
Yeah,
good.
Yeah, no, they're very good. But
good.
I'm just saying, still.
Mm-hmm.
It's hysterical. The one thing they ask
good,
me to do.
Good. Then stick to radio and shut up. You don't need to go.
I can't really
else.
Shut up on radio, Sam.
No, shut up about those things. But no, I mean, I can totally relate to that. You know, I mean, I've done this kind of work for many years. Not filing. I mean, I did my share of filing, but still working in an office. You know, 10 hours a day. I don't know how I ever did it. I have no idea.
You know, you're kind of down the middle. I feel like you have organization, but I also feel like you have creativity.
Yeah, I do.
So to me, it doesn't look like it would be way out of place for you to be in office.
No, but now
but
it would
But it was killing
be.
You? Yeah, now it would.
Now that I haven't done it in a while, there's
long,
no way
how,
I can go back to
what were you doing
that.
In office before?
I was doing accounting.
Well, I've heard
online
that's like
marketing.
Suicidal.
Yeah. You know, that it's not interesting. So I would always find interesting things to do or interesting ways to do things. And always improve.
Did you go to school for accounting?
You know? No, I didn't graduate. I mean, I have a business degree, but accounting was just part of the program.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not like I would major in something like that. No. I majored in marketing. That's more like it for me, you know. And but, you know, I was good at accounting. I had learned it on my own for the most part.
Yeah.
Worked at it for many years. And then, you know, I had my own business where I was going to businesses and doing this. Mm. So that was a little easier because I'd get to go out and drive from one place to the other. And, you know, I wouldn't have to sit just in that one place. But still, after a while, even, you know, going to different clients every day, it still was getting on my nerves, you know.
Mm.
So this radio thing came in just at the right time, you know, because I don't know what I would have done otherwise. But I was really tired of this office work. It's not for everyone. You
no,
know?
It's
some
not.
Some people enjoy it.
No, I mean, for some people are really good. I have a friend of mine. I mean, it's killing her too, though. But she's really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But she's overworked. I mean, it seems like everybody's overworked because they don't want to hire a lot of people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You've got people doing. She's literally doing about 3 people's jobs. She says, Kara, I can't get it all done. And people are upset. And they don't know what I have to do. And she goes, so-and-so says, you need this. You need that. You need to update this. And she's just like, take a number. I mean, who do I do first? And she goes, some things are just not going to get done.
Right.
Because she's working essentially 3 people's jobs.
Yeah, that's what's happening today, you know.
Yeah.
When people have to be a lot more productive since they're laying off a lot of people. So you have to do 3 people's job. You
know? I know, isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Totally crazy.
Yeah. So you don't belong in an office. You realize
oh, no.
that yesterday.
Oh, no. I have to be talking with people. I have to be shaking my little bushy squirrel tail. I gotta be just like... You know, talking to people, having I can't. And it's quiet. It's really quiet in there.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're out of there.
Yeah, well, it's one
it
day.
Is very quiet, huh? It can drive you crazy.
Yeah, I just, it's like a work machine.
Yeah.
Everybody's focused on tasks. I hate that word, tasks. Chores.
It means you have to do something with
a
goal.
No, I don't mind having goals, but they better be fun goals.
Yeah.
Or there better be something fun in the goals.
Yeah.
None of the kind of goals where you know.
Yeah, you're not going anywhere with them.
No, hell no.
Yeah.
Hell no.
So you had yourself a 4-day weekend.
What did I do?
Did you keep yourself busy?
I enjoyed it.
I'm sure.
I got a lot of working out in, actually. I love being outside, so I did a lot of hikes, did some running. In fact, I kind of did like a marathon weekend of just running around and literally, if I was going to go meet a friend for breakfast, I ran to the meter.
Really?
And then I ran to meet my other friend afterwards.
Uh-huh.
to just hang out, and then I run. You know, I'm just a lot of running and walking. So I think I did like Sunday. I think I did, or Monday. I think I did like 10 miles.
Seriously?
Yeah, of walking and running, because I was just it was all broken
That's
up.
That's a lot.
It was all broken up. I just went all over the city.
Yeah.
And instead of driving.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's good though, because it's like good, makes up for all the other crap I eat. But I've been cutting back on the eating because my roommate's out of town.
Yeah. She's, what does that mean?
Well, she's kind of like my eating partner.
I see. Okay.
And
so
I just,
when she's not around.
I haven't had anybody over since she's been gone, so I need to have like a little get together this week. So we
yeah.
Can, yeah.
So what is it you wrote on Facebook that you've been using everything of hers or what?
It's a joke, but not uh-huh. really. But it's primarily a joke. Did you see it? Did you see it?
I did. What'd you
funny?
Mention? Pandies there?
We have a joke where, well, where I didn't know I was going to talk about this, but because what happens if you put things like she one time. We went out. I think I told you this, but we went out and we go to Birds, which has like the this bird cage that we love to dance in. And we had friends out of town. I was planning on going full throttle.
Right.
I was planning on getting my tweet on in the bird cage. I was gonna dance. Uh-huh. And we were changing dresses, and I called her. I was like, Sarah, hey, listen, I need you to bring some white full coverage panties over because uh-huh. I'm wearing a white dress, and you know I don't want to flash anybody. And I didn't have any. I had like thongs or whatever. And she said, okay, I got you covered. So she comes over. We're all getting ready. We change our outfits like 10 times. She actually puts my white dress on. She doesn't wear it. I put on a red dress. I take it off. Anyway, I end up back in the white dress, and I go, hey, Sarah, I'm going to – you got those panties? And she says, oh, I said, yeah, cough them up. I need the panties. And she's like, oh, I put them on because I didn't think you're going to use them.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm wearing this white dress. And she's just looking at me, and I'm like, I need those white panties. And I said, well, I didn't even say I'm not going to not wear panties. I said, I'm not going to not dance, Sarah. I looked at her, I'm like, well, I'm not going to not dance. So the next thing I know, she drops her drawers and takes these white panties off and gives them to
wow.
me. She gives them to me, and I said, you're disgusting. I'm not wearing your panties. She's like, they were only in like 20 minutes. They're fresh. They're uh-huh. fresh. They were only in 20 minutes. I said,
I haven't peed yet.
She's like, these are just, I was like, Sarah, we are so disgusting. We're disgusting human beings. We are disgusting human beings. And so I put on the panties.
But you did.
I put on the panties, yeah. And I said, oh, they feel moist. They feel moist. She goes, they're only in 20 minutes. I said, they feel moist. She goes,
I'm sure there'd be some guys who'd pay a lot of money for those.
And she goes, it's just sweat. It's just a little sweat. I said, you're disgusting. And what's worse is I'm disgusting and I'm wearing them. So I freaking wore her panties. So then we talk about getting, you know, like because I wore panties, getting like, you know, little issues down there. Nothing. It was just a joke. But mm-hmm. So I just wrote on her Facebook. I'm like, I wore two of your panties.
Yeah. What kind of issues down there?
We call it the itchies.
Oh, I see. You
the
get
itchies.
The itchies if you
well,
if you swap
joke.
Underwear.
I like to make jokes that like her underwear give me stuff.
Oh, I see.
But it doesn't. Okay. It's a joke. It's a joke. It's a everybody joke. In the world that's listening that doesn't do.
Okay.
Everybody else
now
that
she
that
seems
uses
to be
their own.
Like a clean woman.
Oh yes, it's I'm a sure. That's the humor. I mean, if she was like. If she was tramping around on, you know, Sepulveda Avenue at 3 a.m., I wouldn't be making those jokes. It'd be a little too close to home.
Yeah.
But no.
Plus, you know she takes showers because you're right there.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in the shower, but...
No, but you're in the house. You
yeah.
know what's going on.
So it's the funny joke is that, you know, mm-hmm. her panties are skeezing it up.
I see. Okay.
And then I stole... What else did I steal? I had some of her garbanzo beans... Threw away some of her crap that was left that's molded, you know.
Oh God.
You know, like people like with their bread, they buy yeah. this, they buy this organic brown rice bullshit bread that's not even holding together because it's there's nothing in it, and then you have to throw it away like a day later because there's no preservatives.
Oh really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So I threw that away, and then I wrote on there, anybody else want to be a hero? You can leave me alone for 3 weeks. You're gonna come back. It's like a dog. You leave your dog alone.
Yeah.
See where your stuff is. Have fun.
So when's she coming back?
Next week.
Okay, cool.
And it's not bad. I mean, I'm just giving a hard time.
Yeah.
I mean, you miss your friends.
Yeah, you do. I mean, have you felt lonely or?
I don't really feel. I mean, no, I've definitely felt lonely, but no, not this, not now, no.
Mm.
I have a lot going on. I'm kind of busy. I'm kind of working a lot, and
yeah.
It's actually been able to get a lot of work done. I've actually noticed though, because she's been gone and we hang out a lot, I haven't been reaching out to my other friends and doing stuff.
Mm, I see. Okay, so you realize it now.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
But I've been kind of in the zone.
All right. And what's with the hat you're wearing? It's not a very attractive hat.
It's a baseball hat, Sam.
Yeah.
It's,
but it's discolored and it looks dirty.
It
and
is
stuff.
Both.
Yeah?
It's both.
It
but
is.
It's called. I woke up really late.
But we need to get you a nice hat.
I just ran in this damn hat, probably ate dirt in this hat, probably fell off a mountain and hiked in this hat. Now you're making my head itch. It is. It's gross. Can you handle it, though? Because I'm not taking my hat off.
No, I can handle it.
Do you want to see my hair? My hair looks bad today. This is a rough day. Can I have a rough day?
Why are you having a rough day?
Because I know. I just mean I woke up late.
Oh, so, I see. So no time for your hair.
No. Look at my hair. Watch.
No makeup.
I've got a little makeup on. See? It's like all over.
Your hair looks fine.
I'm not wearing my freaking hair like this, Sam. You'd rather look at this?
It's like wild and unkempt and everything, but it looks fine.
I'm not wearing it like this. I'm putting a hat on.
Okay, well, that's because you put it under the hat. That's why it looks like that. But at any rate, I mean, I'm not going to give you a hard time. If you want to wear a hat, wear a hat.
Even if it's dirty?
Even if it's dirty. Yeah, just don't go outside so nobody can see you.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to go.
Don't embarrass us.
Whatever.
Yeah. So what's going on with the dating this weekend? I know you had
I've had many of them
lined up.
I went on a bunch. A couple of them were kind of effeminate. A couple guys couldn't pay. And I'm like, you know what? I'm supposed to go.
Really? It keeps coming up, huh?
I told you about going out to my favorite place and that dude's card got declined and everything.
Right.
Yeah, that I'm like.
So we know that one.
Yeah, well, let's say two issues. But honestly, I'm kind of like, well, I'm really just not in a place where I can afford to date if the guy's not going to pay. So until I can afford to date, which I think the guy should pay, but, you never know, you never know. Maybe that's being presumptuous.
Maybe you can ask him beforehand, are you going to pay for the dinner?
That's so romantic.
Yeah, well.
Hey.
It's also not romantic when they ask you to pay, right? It's not romantic to you.
Well, I just think, I'll just take care of my responsibilities and make sure I have it covered in case.
Yeah.
And then go out, as opposed to just Russian rouletting it. And them going, oh, okay.
So how many dates did you go on between Friday and last night?
I went Friday. What did I do? This weekend has been kind of. No, I went on a coffee date. The guy kissed me. It was weird. We were getting into like a debate. You know me. That's the way I do it.
The guy kissed you? Let me hear that.
It wasn't anything romantic. We were talking God chats. We were having God chats, and we were kind of.
Well, obviously.
Obviously. What else is a turn on? And we were talking, and it was nice. It was a coffee, just out coffee. Then we walked around outside near where I live. It's really nice. And we were chatting and kind of getting into it, like, just like a little debate. And I guess I couldn't tell if he was like overcome with the moment or if he was trying to shut me up. Mm-hmm. So he's like, oh, and he like leans in, grabs my face to like, and he did that like half eyed look where you're like, he didn't look where like you're kind of like, and his eyes are halfway open. And so he's kind of like feeling something, but I don't know what it is. I don't even know if he's feeling me, but he's feeling something.
Uh-huh.
And he grabs me to kiss me, and I pull my face away because I'm like, I'm not feeling this. Like, this is either you're trying to shut me up because we're having a conversation.
Yeah.
Or.
So he just leans over and kisses you on the lips?
Yeah. It wasn't like open mouth.
Right.
But it was like a peck, but he was trying to be kind of romantic, and I pulled away, and he grabbed my head still and kissed me.
Really?
I was like, oh, this is not. He like totally stole
That's
it.
That's not you.
I don't mind being manhandled a bit, but I want to be manhandled by the right guy.
Yeah, or someone you've known maybe for a couple dates or something. You know, I mean, how do people have the balls to do that?
I mean, I guess he thought it was romantic, and I get the concept could have been romantic had we had enough attraction, but it was barely there.
Really?
Yeah. He's a cool guy, but I mean, I'm just.
But I mean, you would kiss like on the first date like this?
No, you wouldn't. Not on the first date, no.
Right.
No, I mean, not that it's a rule I have. I mean, I don't have a rule that I won't kiss on the first date, but I just generally don't. Because for me, it takes a little bit more to get.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, you need to warm up a little bit. Yeah.
I mean, I think I've kissed somebody on their cheek or something.
Uh huh.
Isn't that nice? All right.
So lame.
Well, on the first date.
Yeah, the first date, you don't kiss anything.
Well, let me just tell you, some bottles of wine are better with time, right? I'm just saying, if you knew how passionate and how into it I get, then you'd wait.
I would imagine.
You don't have to rush that shit.
I would imagine.
You
must be very hungry by now.
It's not just hunger. It's like a dam of passion. Like you've stored up passion.
Right.
And you want to have the right connection with somebody too. But I think we're all capable of being super passionate.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like if you're kind of like giving it away so easily, I think it dilutes it, it waters it down, and it's not as concentrated on someone.
Well, you know, I mean, people have to have some class, you know. Well, yeah. I mean, it's pretty offensive, I think, to try and kiss someone before you even know them.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? It wasn't like... And you think that, like, he went in to, like, kiss me, and he grabs the back of my neck kind of to pull me in my cheeks. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, wait a second, hold on. And I pulled back, and then he just pulled in harder. And I was like, And I didn't like it. I just felt like it was,
Yeah.
It was just a peck on my lips, but still, I just...
Right, yeah. I mean,
it's personal.
You're not like that.
Like, I've got good lips. Like, you don't just...
And you walk around saying how people shouldn't feel entitled to touch you or whatever.
I mean, I didn't feel, you guys, I mean, I didn't feel raped or anything like that. It wasn't that.
Right.
It wasn't like level 10. It was just more of a, you kind of shut yourself up.
I think that means no boundaries. You know, I would be careful of that guy.
I love how Sam's defending me now. He's always telling me to go off and like, enjoy life and have sex. And now he's like, Kara, that means his boundaries are not there. He's not respecting
you.
Well,
yeah, because now I know you, you know.
You're so sweet.
I know what you like and what you don't.
Well, I want romance and I want like, the real deal.
I'm sure.
I want
to
feel...
I'm sure, but it has to develop, you know. I would never do that.
I went out with a guy. This guy... Sometimes it takes time to develop because I've gone on a couple dates with a guy who's just such a gentleman, and he's got the whole masculine thing going on.
Right.
And he's funny and really, 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 like, when we've gone out, we're going out tonight actually. But when I've gone out with him, he really makes an effort to make me feel special.
Mm.
I mean, just little things.
Yeah.
I mean, men have an ability. Men really have an ability to make a woman feel nervous and special and cute. They really do.
Yeah.
I don't think they realize that. Because a lot of them don't choose to do it or you know, they don't really feel like they want to.
Maybe you've seen something that's not there. I don't know.
Well, I think with men, it's just like with, okay, let's take men with women. Like, I was with a guy and this really beautiful woman walked in. He's a friend of mine.
Right.
And it made him so nervous. He goes, there's something about women that scare me but turns me on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wearing kind of a real fitted dress and she was very beautiful.
Right.
And there was something about her body shape and her feminine energy and her femininity that I'm used to. I mean, I look at her and go, oh, she's pretty, but it doesn't make me feel that way with
right.
him. It makes him tingle and makes him like
nervous. Yeah, yeah.
Makes him
that
nervous.
Does happen.
And he said it almost scares him a bit, like her feminine energy, but he likes it. Like, he likes that fear.
Yeah.
If you want to call it fear, but like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And does that make any sense to you as a
no,
man?
No, no, but you know what? I mean, yeah, I can see being turned on and everything, but I don't know about the fear. It's not really fear.
Like, not
I mean,
fear, but like maybe a little intimidation or something.
Yeah, I mean, if you're considering walking up to her and striking up a conversation, I would imagine that. But if you're just looking at her, what's there to be
afraid of? But I mean, I guess what he's saying is like an excitement
mm-hmm.
that kind of is intimidating a bit, and
yeah.
that she's the feminine energy.
Yeah.
I think
whatever he feels, I'm sure it's genuine.
But I'm just trying to say that kind of essence that women have over men.
Right.
Men have that version of themselves with women.
Mm.
Like, if a man is really cordial to a woman, I mean, maybe some women are bitches and they don't care, because I know some women that are like that. They're like, I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? And they just don't even, they're so used to being, I guess, they just expect it. That they're just like, they don't get it. But I think men have that same capability. Like, when a man opens a door and he is constantly checking in to see if she needs anything, and I just think that stuff, it makes me really nervous, but I like
right.
it. Like, as a woman, it's like, oh, my God. But it makes me nervous, but it makes you feel good.
Yeah, I suppose.
I think men don't realize they have that ability, because if they did, I think they'd do it more.
Yeah.
I think they'd be more inclined to, you know, be more, I guess, nurturing or caretaking, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think it makes women feel, like, giddy and kind of, like, nervous and...
Yeah, but what if you don't know the guy's nervous? Why would it make you nervous?
No, it's not about his nervousness. I'm saying if a man knew that he had the same effect on a woman.
Oh, I see.
Like,
okay.
If he were to do those little things like mm-hmm. Checking in if she needs stuff. I don't know. When you pamper a woman, I guess.
Right.
You're kind of...
Attentive.
Attentive.
Right. Well, okay.
Those things...
Sounds good.
Those,
yeah,
or
I can
opening
see how
doors,
you'd like that.
Opening doors and really kind of making... kind of guarding her space, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I don't even really know how to articulate it, but
yeah.
It's an energy that makes I like am turned on, but it makes me nervous, like
yeah.
super nervous.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I guess it does. Well, in a few minutes we're going to today, for some reason, our show is marked by Islam, and we're going to have two people that are Muslims, and one wrote they both wrote books. And but about different things, and I thought it was pretty interesting. But it, I guess the underlying tone here is that there's a lot of oppression going on. You know? And then people grow up and they realize it's not for them, and they don't want to do it, and that sort of thing, you know. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this, and we'll call the first author.
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station, your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
I've been trying to find a situation to straighten out my life. 'Cause in every part that I've been playing, something isn't right. Cause if what you do is a good thing,
proliferates the internet. Two people have teamed up to save the world. It's Sam and Kara in the morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Okay, and we're back. And Kara, actually, our guest arrived early, which is excellent.
Yeah, it's
good
a
morning
first.
To you.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Roxana Shirazi in the studio. And thank you for making all the way here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was actually not that far.
So. Okay, wonderful. So we'll get to your story in a little bit, but I'm glad you're here because we're going to call an author who is... you're Iranian, right?
Yes, I am.
You're originally
yes.
from there, and this author is also Iranian. And he wrote a book on comparing the religions, the major religions, and I found it to be very interesting to see... you know, the views of a real Muslim.
Hello.
You know. Yes, good morning. We're calling for Mr. Pur Hassan, please.
Yes, that's me. Go ahead.
Oh, that's you. Okay, I'm sorry. Good morning to you. Your first name is, how do you pronounce it?
Nader.
Nader.
Or Nader, whichever is easier for
okay,
you.
Okay, Nader. We want to call you the with the original pronunciation. So.
Nader, hello.
Yeah. So we have, of course, Kira is with me in the studio.
Hello.
And we also have Roxana here, Shirazi, and she happens to be an Iranian as well, and she's our next guest. So this is going to be an exciting topic to talk about. You wrote the book called God's Scripture, a faithful Comparison, What Jews, Christians, and Muslims Must Know. Let's first start with your story. You were born in Iran, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And when did you come to this country?
End of 1977, close to like 30-some years ago.
I see. Okay, so you've been here for a while. Obviously, you came here as a child. And did you come with your family or on your own?
No, my mother brought me and my older brother and left us at a boarding school. My dad was in the army, Shah's army, and things were getting tense, so they feared for our lives. So they put us over here in America.
Right. Now, was that still the time of the Shah, or was there already a revolution when you came here?
It was about 7-8 months before the revolution.
Oh, right before it. Wow, that's interesting. That's amazing. Yes. So you grew up here in the United States since an early age, and did you go to school here?
Yes, I went to Harding Academy, a Christian school. And after that, I went to Harding University, which was also a Christian university. And then I went to Utah State University, got my Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering. Then I went to Brigham Young University for my master's and ultimately my PhD from University of Utah.
That's interesting. So a Muslim went to a Mormon school.
A Christian school, then a Mormon school.
Yeah.
I like it. You're just like doing the sample platter style. You're like, yeah, let's just
try it.
When in Rome, let's just try it all out. I like it.
Well, I went to Brigham Young. They offered me scholarship and it was very important financially. It was a great help. So I went to that school.
That's cool. That's cool. Now, I started reading your book, and you were talking about how opposed your family and your culture is to Christians. Tell us a little bit about that. What inspired you to write the book? I guess that's the main question I'm asking.
Right. I grew up as a fanatic Muslim, and when I came to America, I hated Americans and Christians and Jews equally. And my fanatic background was from my mother's side. My dad was pro-American, and that's why he wanted us to come to America to get education. Right. But once I married a Christian woman, the marriage didn't work out ultimately, but I realized what kind of harsh rules I am going by and how much controlling I was with my ex-wife. So I went to the Quran and I started reading the Quran, and I saw that everything that I raised by was opposite, and there was no hatred toward Christians in the Quran. It actually praised Christians, and one-third of the Quran is about the Jews and praising the Jews are the people of God, and everything that I read, it was opposite, so I was shocked. I read it again, and I read it again and again, and I said, my God, how could this be so different? So when I went to the Bible, I realized that in the time of Jesus was actually dealing with the exact same kind of thing. He was opposed by the religious leaders who were used to the religion in certain way, and they didn't want him to change anything. And the corruption of religion happens, in my opinion, in the hands of religious leaders who put their own two cents into religion and make it a completely different thing. That's why we see all the wars in the Abrahamic religion, Jews, Christian, and Muslim, it's because of all the different branches coming with different leaders, and they have different agenda than God himself.
Right. Mm. So now you married a Christian woman. How did your family react to that? I mean, did they disown you? What happened?
My mom was very shocked. She immediately disowned me and called me a non-believer and an atheist and everything that she could call me besides that I can't say in the radio. But yeah.
You can on our station, but that's okay.
You know, and it was very devastating to her. She wanted me to marry a very fanatic lady from Iran, and she would want to be in charge of that, and she wanted me to have that kind of life in a fanatic way.
Right.
So it was very hard on her, and she couldn't get along with my ex-wife, and those tensions keep, you know, besides having the differences of religion and difference of opinions and all the tensions in the family, ultimately got to the point that she couldn't handle it anymore, and she divorced me.
Can I ask you a question?
There's an echo.
Okay, so my question for you is, as a man growing up in a faith that's been, you know, amplified, and you're seeing the perversion of it, but it supports men. It's a man-centered. I'm not going to necessarily say the faith is, you're saying, the true intent, but what we're talking about, the fanaticism, it supports masculinity and it supports man's dominance. Where were you with that? I mean, as far as experiencing this kind of system of belief that allowed men to kind of dominate and rule over women and have this kind of power and control. How are you not attracted to that? And not as ignorant as the question may sound, I really do mean it, because it seems like that would be, it's even more phenomenal for a man to go, I don't want this. Whereas a lot of women are oppressed and they usually want to get away from it. Whereas right. A lot of men are doing the oppression. So I'm curious how that came about.
Well, that's a very good question. As a man, when you're growing up in the young ages, I was 100% okay with it. I didn't know there was anything wrong with it, especially when all the women around me were just fine with it, my sister, my mom, and they thought that's the way God wanted it. And I thought to myself, if God wanted it, that's great, that's the way it should be. But once you grow up and once you get married and you start to have to care for the person who you're married to, you see that, hey, this is not very just to them. And then when you have a daughter, you really start questioning it if you're a good man. And if you're a bad man, you don't never question it. You oppress your family and you don't care. You just keep going in that direction. But people at one point, they will question themselves. Some people suppress those questions inside themselves, never talk about it, and they just say, well, that's what God wants it. I didn't do that. I said, I want to make sure that's what God wants. So I read the Quran, and I realized that it is opposite of the Quran. Actually, everything there is opposite. But the women in the Islamic world, they need to know that. For example, I have a challenge in my website that's called $1,000 Challenge. I say that there is no verse in the Quran that says women should cover their hair. That should be a woman's choice whether they want to cover their hair or not. And it shouldn't be forced on them. In Iran, they force people, they punish them violently if they don't cover their hair. So women should be educated that, hey, they don't have the right to oppress you. They don't have the right to tell you to do this or that. And that is not supported in the Quran.
You're telling me that there's not one verse in the Quran that says women should have coverings or wear their hair covered at all?
That's right. And if somebody brings that, they get $1,000. My website, you know,
can I have your $1,000? Because I have read the Quran thoroughly, and that it does say that women should be modest. They should cover themselves for all other men except their husbands. So I do have the Quran, and it does say that, I'm afraid, Nader.
Well, it doesn't, and in chapter 24, the verse that you're referring to, I put those verses there. There is nowhere in Quran that talks about hair, woman hair,
It does. Sorry, but it does. I don't know what kind of Quran you've got. I don't know what kind of Quran's version you've got, but I have a Quran's version in English and in Iranian, and in Arabic, and there is...
the verse, and I will read it for you right now from the version that you have.
Well, I wish I had mine here and I would read it to you. I think that's what you're saying is ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
Sorry,
I'm sure. I mean, you're Iranian. I came to England when I was 10, so I'm not, you know, I mean, obviously we're both Iranian, but I don't understand why you're saying that there's nowhere in the Quran that says
is he saying Nader, are you saying that that there's no literal words of cover thy hair, but yet to be modest? Is that what we're disagreeing on that?
That's correct. In the Bible and the Quran equally says women should be dressed modestly. In the Quran, all the places in the Quran where it talks about covering, I took every verse out. I mean, I took every content that is in the Quran and put it in perspective. So every verse that you want, I can quote you right now exactly that verse, if you like.
Yeah.
And the verse that she's talking about, which is, you're right, it talks about modesty, but you're wrong about saying cover the head. It says a man should, the verse starts by saying a man should not look at a woman with lusting and should cover his private parts. And it says a woman should also cover her private parts and should not display her beauty ornaments, the ornaments that they used to have, to the people unless they are their kin. And this is the same thing in the Bible. Now, it also says another verse in the Quran, chapter 33, it says that a woman, Prophet Muhammad says that to his wives and daughters and all the women that who have faith, to be covered more so you will be recognized as a modest woman, so bad men who have a bad heart and they want to hurt you, they won't come and hurt you. Nowhere in the Quran it says a woman should cover the hair or her head. Right. In the Bible, in Paul, in New Testament, which I don't go with that, I go with the New Gospel, but the only place that talks about head exactly, it says a woman should not shave her head. The hair is her glory and should be shown. Now, that's what it says in the Bible. In the Quran, it doesn't even say the word hair or cover the head. So the verse that is, everybody thinks that, everybody who don't know the Quran and just know the Islamic, today Islam, they say, oh, no, that's in the Quran. And they jump to my website, which is christianmuslim.org, and they put a verse, and when I quote that verse for them, they go, oh, you're right, there is no place that says hair, cover your hair.
Right.
And that's amazing, you know.
Well, let's not get hung up on this one thing.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, of course.
I'm not anti-Islam at all. I'm not anti-religion.
No, but this is an open forum.
There is stuff in the Quran that says about stoning.
Right.
You know, stoning for adultery. It does say that. And it does say
stuff about...
And it does say about a man can... a husband can have sex with his wife forcefully. It does say that. I have read the Quran. Yes, it does. You're talking rubbish. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, let's not get hung up on specific things here. What you know, especially since the Bible is open to interpretation, and I'm sure the Quran is the same way.
Well, the Bible
everybody
has
sees whatever they want.
The Bible has. I mean, the Bible's. I mean, it's funny. We always talk about the Christian community sometimes is so. It's so hallmark that if you were to take the whole Bible and make it into a movie, a lot of Christians wouldn't even go see it because it deals with real life stuff. And a lot of it has adultery, incest, it's stoning. And it's not because God's advocating it, but they put the real life issues and the things that went on in there. So, I mean, I'd have to read the Quran. I've never really fully read it. I've read parts of it to really realize what the context of what those passages were, the historical meanings. And is that because that's what they're advocating in those passages, or is that because of what took place? And I think that's, anytime you're dealing with a religious book, it's kind of like looking at it from those perspectives, because there's a lot of shit goes down in the Bible that's God's not really advocating, but it's in the Bible, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would be interested to know more about it. But Nader, I want to go back to this marriage with, you move here to America, and you said that you hated Americans originally. And then you go from that to marrying a Christian woman, and that's before you even totally gave up on Islam, right?
That's correct.
Fascinating. How did that happen?
Well, I was a martial art instructor in Brigham Young University, and my ex-wife was my student, and she was very beautiful. And when we start talking and working out together, I was very attracted to her. And I did not think about Islam and or anything like that. I just thought that if I tell her that I like her and she likes me, and then we start liking each other even more, I wanted to marry, then we just married. And I didn't question those things, because when you fall in love, you just go with that. And I did that, and I thought she would eventually would change to Islam, like a lot of Muslim guys who marry a Christian person, and they eventually forced them by their harsh rules to change. And this person did not only change, he said, enough is enough, you can just take your religion and go wherever you want, but not with me. And that was shocking to me, because I had a son and I was very much emotional with him. And when I look at the Quran and then try to check these things out, nowhere in the Quran talks about that. It talks about stoning women in the Bible, but it doesn't talk about it in the Quran. And these are all misrepresentations because of, you know, people making laws that is not in the Quran. I'm hoping to be able to bring that awareness to people who like to know the truth about the Quran.
Right. Now, let me ask you this question. You know, I mean, Muslims claim that Islam is a religion of love and peace. And my question is, and I'm sure a lot of people are asking the same thing, is how come, you know, most of the flashpoints in the world right now somehow or other involve violent Muslims? And so, I mean, where's the love here? Where's the peace?
If anybody claims that today Islam is the religion of love, they really got it backward and they really messed up, because today Islam is nothing but hatred. And even the fanatic Muslims who are like Osama bin Laden is a very small minority. But the majority of Muslims, they don't stand up against this kind of thing. They are also brainwashed by the religious leaders. Islam is nothing to be proud of. Today Islam is nothing aligned with Quran. It's all changed by the so-called hadith, which is a word from Prophet Muhammad they claim to be, and it's not in the Quran. So today Islam is awful, in my opinion. It's nothing what the Prophet Muhammad would be proud of it, or Jesus Christ would be proud of it. You know, it would be completely against the Quran what it is. And I'm intended to show to the world, or whoever I can, even one person, my friend, that hey, look at it. It's not in the Quran. And if anybody wants the truth, they should just look at those verses and see, yeah, it is not.
Have you been at this point? I mean, you've come out with your book. It's a comparative religious studies. And I intend to read it. It seems pretty fascinating. Are you completely disowned from? I mean, like I know some Iranian artists that I've worked with that they won't even go back to their country because of the regime. And if they go back to their country, that there's possibilities of them being targeted just because, not because they're like, you know, anti-Muslim or anti-Iranian, but just because you can't really be famous. Like he's kind of said, you know, you can't really steal the thunder or, you know, be a big deal over there. And I'm wondering, you know, if you guys have, for lack of a better word, defected from your original faith on such a public way, coming out with a book, and now you married a Christian woman. I mean, what would happen if you were to go back, or have you gone back? And I'm, you know.
Well, my mother, who's a fanatic Muslim, actually went to a religious leader and showed my book to them and said, "Can my son come to Iran?" And they said, "Let us read it." They read it and they said, "If he comes to countries around us, we still will find him and kill him."
Yeah.
So the question of going back to Iran is impossible. The ironic thing about this is I'm trying to talk against the evilness that is in the world of Islam and try to give credibility to the Quran, because it doesn't support that. So I get hammered from every direction.
Yeah.
The people who hate Islam, they hate the Quran mistakenly. They hammer me, and the people who are in Iran, the religious leaders, they hate me because, you know, I'm saying that, hey, this religion, Bible and the Quran, they're aligned. They are not against each other, and they're not promoting war. They have to put everything in the context that it talks about. There is no way to interpret any word of God in a wrong way unless you want to do it maliciously. You know, when it says, thou shalt not kill, how can you interpret that to thou shalt kill? You know, when he says love the Christian and the Jewish, they are your brother, how could you change that to kill the Christians because they're Americans, or kill Christians, the Israelis, because they're Jews? I am intent to show that there is no way to interpret these words wrong. People who do it, they do it just for their own intention, and anybody with logic will look at them will see that this is not right.
Well, isn't there, I mean, I know it's so heavy on interpretation and how you view the scriptures. I mean, just as a Christian, and the endless in-house debates that you have with other Christians about the meaning and division, and hopefully at the end of the day you can kind of lay down some of that and come to some common grounds of what do you basically believe. Like, okay, well, you know, we may be, some may be Baptist, maybe Protestant, maybe whatever, but you hopefully we believe in Christ and we believe in love. Hopefully we can agree on one thing here, you know? But going to the Quran, the little that I've read about it, and it's very, very enough to get myself in trouble, so here we go, because that's what I do, is, you know, there's a shift that they say Muhammad took a shift, that he started off in a lot of his teachings very peaceful, very, like, they call it, the Christians were called people of the way, people of the book, and there was supposed to be kind of an alliance, kind of an ally-type relationship where there was love, there was a respect, and you're not to harm them, and really talking a lot about that love. But then Muhammad himself, some speculate, if he went through some kind of weird spiritual transition or, you know, psychosis even, and I say that as from commentary I've read, that through his shift through the Quran, that he then changes his stance a bit to that if there comes to a place where if anyone's an infidel, meaning, you know, anybody that is not a believer in Allah, that if, you know, push comes to shove, you can annihilate them. Now, that these schools of thoughts kind of they shift. So both are true. Like, yes, he's advocating love and peace and the brethren, and we're all kind of on the same page. Then it's like, boom, forward, 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 flash forward. He kind of takes a different stance. If the circumstances change and people are infidels, then boom, you can kind of eradicate them. Well, what do you say about that?
These are all wrong information that people accepted it from Muslim religious leaders and the Ahadith. If you go by Ahadith, you can justify, but absolutely impossible to justify this when you read the Quran. Muhammad was in Mecca, he was kicked out, and then when he went to Medina, they wanted to kill him. When he became strong, he went back to Mecca, and he didn't even kill a single person. In chapter 48, verse 25, it says, Muhammad, do not attack Mecca, because there might be some innocent people over there that might die. So that, what they say that this is what the shift is, was, it was completely not founded in the Quran. It is the last chapter that came to Prophet Muhammad is chapter 5, which is called the Last Supper of Jesus Christ. In that chapter, he talks about Jesus very highly. He talks about the Last Supper. The chapter, one year before that, he talks about the Christians, the followers of Jesus Christ, are above the non-believers until the end of the world. But let me just put a complete at ease for everybody if they like to. But they asked Jesus in the Bible in Matthew, what is the biggest commandment of all? And he says, hey, love your God with all your heart and all your mind. He says, what is the second one? He says, love your neighbor like yourself.
Amen.
He said, that's it? They go, yeah. Jesus said, based upon those two commandments, all the laws rest on that. Mm. Those two commandments are repeated in the Quran 72 times. It says, amana billah wa amelu salihat, believe in God and do good. That was manipulated by a religious leader who became political and tried to use religion to make money and have power. There is no way to interpret being good to go and kill somebody. Mm. Those books are awesome. They are from God. The world cannot be changed. There is nothing there that insinuates that you should be able to kill if you want to. In the Bible and the Quran, to defend. So, and that's all.
Where do you stand now on an individual level as far as your faith?
I believe I'm a Jew, Christian, and Muslim, because they all are about those two laws that I just told you. Mm. You know, they believe in God and do good. And if you look at the non-believers, some of them are better than the believers because they realize that. They realize, hey, I don't want to believe in this God that the believers believe because they're always fighting. I'm just going to be good. Well, the person who's good, by being good, that's the shows what faith they have. That's in Peter. Peter says, don't tell me you believe in God. Even demons believe in God and they fail. Do good so you can be known as a good person. Then that means you're a believer. So I try to be a believer and I try to do good because throughout the 47 years of my life, I've done plenty of bad things. So hopefully I make it up and try to be a good person from now.
Yeah. Now, I have a final question for you. We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what is the reason you think, I mean, is this anywhere in the Quran, like to hate Israel and the United States so much, Jews, Christians, you know, I mean, is that anywhere in the Bible? Because it seems to be pretty universal. You know, I'm not going to say every Muslim, but, you know, you can, it seems like even countries that have nothing to do with the West seem to hate it so much. Why do you think that is?
That is because the religious leaders, there is minority people, but they control, their followers are very large numbers. In the Quran, if American government would look at these verses, they would be, you know, chanting these verses all over the Middle East to the people. Chapter 3, verse 113 says, among the followers of the scripture, Jews and Christians, they are righteous people. And it goes on to say, they do good deeds, they exceed each other from doing good. They are blessed by God. Chapter 29, verse 46 says, do not argue with Christians, even argument in an unmannered way. Be very polite to them. Chapter 3, verse 33 says, the Christian, the children of Jesus will be above the followers, above all the non-believers. Chapter 355 continues with the same kind of thing. But in the Quran also, it talks about the wars that they had. They also had disagreements. So it says, leave those disagreements alone. Tell the children of Israel, Jews and Christians, that let's have one common thing. We all believe in God and let's do good. That's the verse in the Quran. So if this awareness, if this teaching of Quran comes out, we disarm all the people like Osama bin Laden, all these religious leaders who say hate America and Israel. They're only doing that because it gets popular. When you have a country who's great as America and powerful, there is jealousy. And these countries, when they see their leader says, we don't care about this big man, America, we're going to go and kick his butt, you know, that brings a lot of excitement and energy, and they become, they follow. But if you bring to these Muslim people and tell them, hey, look at the Quran, that's what Quran says, so what about that? They're going to stop, and they're going to think a little bit, most of them. And I know that because I have experienced that kind of change through myself and the friends and people that I talk to. The Quran is completely different. It's a book of life, not book of death, and that's the same thing with the Bible.
Well, I say hallelujah to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking to Dr. Nader Pour Hassan. And the book is God's Scripture, A Faithful Comparison, What Jews, Christians, and Muslims Must Know. Now, you said you had a website. Can you repeat that one again for us?
Sure, thank you. www.christianmuslim.org, M-U-S-L-I-M, .org.
Okay.
Or another website I have, solvingreligion.com, either one.
Okay, sounds good. Nader, thank you so much for your time. We really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. You enlightened us quite a bit. And all the best to you. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye. Okay, so apparently Roxana has a lot to say about this. So we're going to have plenty of time to talk about it all. But you see, that's what this is about. It's about an open forum. You know, let people say what they feel and stuff. And it's interesting, you know, but we'll get your point of view in a minute as well. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this.
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station, your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
Above and beyond, above and beyond, above and beyond. Eurotrash Rock. Let's get back. Let's get to Sam and Kara in the morning.
Kara in the morning.
Right here on LA Talk Radio.
Makes you want to dance.
Oh, yeah. Baby dog. Work it out.
Yeah. All right.
You guys missed it. Sam just had like a little Soul Train moment.
Yeah, there you go. I started dancing.
I liked it. I liked it.
When there's good music, I'll dance. Not on the dance floor, but I'll dance.
That's good.
Yeah. Put your whole body in the the groove, you know.
That's awesome. I love that side of you. Yeah, you didn't get. I mean, maybe I was too lit at your birthday, but nobody was really dancing. It wasn't really a dancing party.
Yeah, no, we weren't dancing and stuff.
We're gonna all have to go out to one of the date I just went on. He took me to an awesome place. Mm-hmm. It's called Burbank Bar and Grill, mm-hmm. and they have this band, a live band that does 70s music, 80s and 90s, and they change their outfits each decade, and they play all the hits, and it's kitschy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not like well, girl. Won't get up on y'all, but it's like everybody's in their groove, and it's so fun, and it's just such a fun environment where people are like dancing and grooving and Motowning it up, but nobody's really trying to like do you that much.
Yeah.
So I was like, man, I want to come back here.
It's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, I want to come back here with my friends. So we'll have to do that because I think you'll like it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, we have Roxana Shirazi in the studio, and you're a Brit, right? I mean, obviously you're from England, but originally you're from Iran, right?
Yeah. I consider myself Iranian.
Right. But so tell us a little bit about this. I mean, you were born in Iran. Yeah. What age did you leave there?
I was sent to England when I was nearly 11.
11, very
during
young.
During the war, yeah.
Yeah. And sent to England. Did you have family there or anything?
My parents sent me to England to live with my uncle. Mm-hmm. It was pretty harsh and grimy. I lived in a ghetto.
Really?
So there was gunshots all the time.
Really?
in London? God.
No, in Manchester, a place called Moss Side, which is like Compton.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
and it was horrible. And then my grandmother died. She was with me. And then I was sent to live with an English family in like another part of the
country.
Like
a foster family or
something? Yeah. I didn't speak English. So they kind of started to learn English mm-hmm. by living with the family. And, you know, like I couldn't even say like, where is the bathroom? So I had to learn really quickly to speak English.
Yeah. At a younger age, it's kind of easier to learn
it
a
is
language,
so
right?
much. When you have to, you know, when you, then there's no one to speak your own language.
Right.
You have to learn pretty fast.
Right.
You know,
wow.
So like you're close to 11, which is still, I mean, there's a lot of life memories there already at 11.
Yes.
A lot of personality things have already developed. I mean, I would think that that's a huge, you know, you grew up fast too. So you were sent there's the war going on in Iran. They send you to live with your uncle.
Yeah.
Then the grandma dies and somehow where's the uncle go?
My uncles who I was sent to live with, they lived in complete dire poverty. Where we didn't have food at all. So they kind of thought when my grandmother died that, you know, it was best to send me off somewhere where I can have a good education. And so this English family actually sort of fostered me. Mm. You know, they were kind enough to do that. So I could have, you know, a good education and food, basically, and eat.
Yeah.
But it actually didn't turn out very good because it was a completely very white middle class place, and I was bullied constantly every day, called really bad racial names mm-hmm. every day, and so it didn't turn out for the better. Actually, I'd rather have lived in the ghetto,
right,
but with my family, my uncles, rather than go to this really white, you know, anti-Iranian kind
of
place.
And you were young, so it must have left a lot of scars.
Yeah, it was a horrible year that time, 1985. It was really crucial.
How long were you living with the family? Did you finish high school and everything?
I lived with them for about 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Went to school there. And then one day, my mother came to England with my brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And no one told me. It was like a really good surprise. You know, I opened the door and there she was. And
aww.
I opened the door and I was so happy, you know, to see my mommy. You know?
Wow, I'm sure. My God, you know.
It was really nice.
Yeah.
And then you lived with your mom after
Yeah,
that.
And then me, my mother, my brother and sister lived together then, yeah.
And where did you guys live? Did you stay in the wider area or did you stay?
No, we went to a town called Bristol, which is about 2 hours from London. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was nice to be with my mommy, definitely. Yeah.
And were you guys in dire poverty at that point too?
Yeah, it wasn't a nice time at all. I think when I lived in Iran, I had lots of family, lots of love, lots of friends,
right.
and we had a good lifestyle. And then from the age of like 10 till about, well, afterwards, it just went downhill.
Well, because you were uprooted and sent to a new place where you didn't know
anything. Yeah, the money thing. You guys didn't have the cash, right?
Nothing. Yeah. My mom actually was a psychologist and a teacher in Iran, and she went from that to cleaning people's homes in England, and it was like a complete step down for her. Like she did that to make money for us, for food and everything, and she sold her wedding jewelry and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we kind of went from a really loving lifestyle with my aunts, uncles in Iran, and a loving sort of environment to completely nothing.
Yeah.
It was like empty black nothing, you know, in a bad area.
Nothing. Yeah, nothing in common with the people or anything. Yeah.
Nothing, no.
How did it, but you guys were going through a war, right?
Yeah.
And so it was one of those, okay, well, anything could happen if you stayed behind, like death or...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to come to England. And
yeah, of course. I mean, you're 10 years old, too.
I wanted to be with my friends and play with my friends and do things. And but I think my mom was sort of... I think she regrets it now, sending me over at such a young age. But she was saying to me, there's a war going on. The government, the regime was horrendous, you know. I mean, it was horrific.
Can you
kind
of paint the picture for us a little bit? I mean, I know a bit about it, but as far as like...
Well, I think it was kind of... I remember the revolution. It was in 1979. And I think up to then, it was the Shah's time. It wasn't as bad. And then when the revolution happened, I remember immediately things started to get really bad. And I remember things like, you know... If women obviously had to cover up, and it was like things like showing wearing makeup, nail polish, things like that was punishable by like torture, being imprisoned.
Right.
You couldn't play music. Music was illegal. You couldn't dance. Lots of things. It was like the complete height of like, you know, the revolution of completely prohibiting and restricting everything that sort of reflected the Shah or Americanism or Westernization. So even ties were a sign of counter-revolutionary signs. The men didn't wear ties.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everything. Like, I remember the Revolutionary Guards used to stop and see if the woman was wearing makeup, and they would, like, put a blade in a tissue. So when she wiped her lips, it would cut her lips.
Wow.
It was really a horrific, scary time. And I was quite young, but I still remember being scared of, like, you know.
Oh, my gosh. That is just...
Cover up and really cover up. And I was nearly taken to a prison. I was 8. I was sitting in a car once, and actually a bit of my hair was showing. And the Revolutionary Guard stopped my parents' car, and they said, this girl, she's like, you know. She basically called me a whore, basically, as a 7-year-old.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so my parents had to kind of bribe them by cash to not take me to the comité, which was like an office where you get interrogated, you know, for like being anti-Islamic.
Yeah.
Who has the fucking balls to pull over a 7-year-old, call her a whore, and how are you going to interrogate a 7-year-old?
It was really bad. I remember my little sister, who's much younger than me, we took her to nursery, and she was wearing a, like a little girl's dress with no pantyhose or anything. So her legs were and the women in the school were saying to my mother, this is really bad that you're starting at the young age to have her legs out. And my mom was like, she's one.
Yeah.
1 year old. Right, and they were like, this is anti-Islamic. It's like you're showing signs that you're anti-Islam. It's really bad. So we were put to shame. Women were very made to feel shame, great shame.
Right.
You know.
Because that gives them control over you, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know. Yeah. And at school, every day we have to recite the Quran. This was your last guest. You know, actually, it was kind of annoying me because I had to read the Quran every day when I was at school in Iran.
So you're familiar
every
with it.
Every day we were shown things and taught things. And I still have the, you know, two Qurans at home. So I totally disagree with the things he was saying.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, your experience was different than his, you know.
Yeah.
So what did you... I mean, so you were growing up there and it was already locked down. I mean, as a woman as a woman that all I know is a Western civilization, I mean, what I've grown up in, right? And all I know is, I mean, not that I had it easy by any means, but I mean, I've never been through these kind of experiences. And when I hear these stories, you just feel so much rage and hurt and pain and anger, because I think women are, I mean, what I believe in the Bible too is like, you know, this is kind of presumptuous to say, but we talk about like God's creation. He started with light, you know, to light out of darkness, and he formed the land and the sea, and then the animals, and he made man, and then he made woman, and woman was the crowning jewel of creation, is kind of the way I look at it, right? And we're like the last ever made.
How convenient.
I know. Well, I mean, there's people that use that as an argument, but no one's better than anyone in God's eyes. It's not like that. But it's just almost like, and it says that woman is the glory of man, and that's a really beautiful thing. Like when men are proud of their wives, wife or whatever, it's almost like you don't show her off, but in a way you show her off because she's beautiful inside and out, and she brings a, because God, I mean, is feminine and masculine, I believe, and that we represent a different side of the Lord in some ways.
Right.
And so it's so, it pains me when I hear these stories about you take like a flower that's beautiful and then you trample on it and you cut it and you make it bleed. It's like, it's already soft and beautiful and fragile, and you like, you beat it up. It's like, what? Like, you're not a big man if you're not a big man. You're not a big man if you hit.
It's very sad, isn't it?
You interrogate a 7-year-old.
Yeah. It is. It's because women are not, are kind of degendered. It's like when you wear the full hijab, you are a non-gender because you're hiding every curve.
You're almost like a non-person too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you are.
Know, you only have your, you know, you only bare your eyes and everything, and, you know, with the burqas and, you know, and then you can't, it takes away, you become an anonymous person, you know?
A non-person kind of,
I think it's dehumanizing. It's very like, it's almost like, and if you understand, I mean, I think with women have their sexuality, I don't mean just sex, but I mean the essence of femininity, and like you said, a curve, a smile, the energy of a woman has a lot of power. Our sexuality does have power, and I think when men are power hungry, they're offended by your femininity. I mean, even in this society, I've experienced it in like certain industries where just being feminine offends men. Not like, oh, my boobs in your face, but I mean just feminine energy, because they can't, they want to own it, they want to put
control.
Their stamp, they want to control it, they want to put their stamp on it. So it's like you've got all these women in a society that are beautiful or whatever, and they're like, take away the beauty, she's hot, cover her up, that one's hot. It's like they're pissed off.
It's a symbol of kind of a threat in a way.
It's freedom.
You know, it has been like this throughout history, you know, like when women couldn't vote, and when the women wanted to vote in the 1920s, this whole theory of penis envy came about by psychiatrists as a truth. And that was coincided with the time when women posed a threat to the unit of the family.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to vote. They didn't want to be just a house. They wanted to vote. So psychiatrists has invented that women actually envy the penis.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't think, I mean, I don't
I just, sorry.
Well,
I just
maybe they do, but that's beside the point. Right?
I don't know about envy. I've never gone, man, I could go
envy,
for
it. Not envy, but desire for, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you want him to be packing some heat, but I've never wanted to strap one
to
on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not. And I mean, I think men are more envious of penises than women, to be honest.
Probably. They think about it all the time.
They think about it
they?
All the time. I'm like, do you understand that women just don't care?
Yeah, I know.
Like, we don't really care. We want to make sure it's there and it works and it can go for a while.
Right.
But we don't really need to, I don't want to see a picture of it on a wall.
Yeah.
I don't want, you know.
Well, you have to understand men, you know, because you have an appendage, you know, and it's an external organ and it's there all the time and you're aware of it all the time.
And that's
cool.
I mean, just like women have things we're aware of and men are like, whatever, we don't care. But I'm just saying men have this kind of narcissistic view of their genitals as though women think and I think what happens is women play into that a bit because they want to be cool and hot and edgy. But I don't think women are as fascinated. I mean,
we just play men at their own game. We just think, oh, we'll just go with what you say, but we're actually laughing at them.
Yes, it's so funny. Wow. So going back
I mean, so you grew up as a good girl and everything, family girl and all that. And at a certain point, that changed, right? I mean, you know, you grew up. Did you go to college?
Well, I went to university in England.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I did my degree in gender and feminisms, and I did my master's in English literature. And you know, actually, I always said there's a really complete two split sides to me. I'm a complete nerdy, bookish, like dork, one side, which just likes nothing more than just to read theory books and politics and literature and things like that. And then there's the other part of me, which is really wild and very sexual and completely like a free spirit, you know.
Right.
So that's always in conflict with each other, these two
sides. I'm sure.
Know?
Especially like all the stuff you were raised with and, you know, and taught and all that.
Mm.
So at what age did you discover your sexuality? I mean, at what point did you decide, wow, you know, I mean, there's more to this than I realized?
Like as a woman coming from that place where it's repressed and then you're...
I was about 5 or 6.
Really?
You know, I was very sexual.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know.
Were you playing doctor and everything?
I did with my male and female neighbors.
Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah.
I was
so
quite a sexual child. I was. I think what I had a bit of a messed up childhood in a way that my father wasn't around. So to sort of compensate for that, I kind of always used to look at, because there were so many soldiers and men of authority on the streets with guns. So I kind of started to replace that not having a father figure with the authority of the soldier or somebody in that sense. So it was a bit weird. And I always, you know.
Where did he go? Do you mind me asking? Or
where did he go? Yeah. Well, he was a drug addict, so
that always messes
he was
up,
around, so. But he was never kind of there. You know, okay. I didn't sort of see him much. You know.
Okay.
So he wasn't around, but I don't know if you've read parts of the book. And in my mm-hmm. early childhood, there was some sexual abuse in my childhood
right.
by three different men. So I wow. never.
And how old were you?
It was from the age of five.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I never understand which one started first. Did I become aware of a too early sexuality because of what happened to me as a child? Or was I already... Because I have a lot of friends who are never molested, but they say to me when they were kids, they had a sense of, you know, naughty sexual feeling. And they were not, you know, interfered with or anything.
Don't you think
like
some
that.
Of that's healthy, though? It's partly, I mean, not...
Yeah,
I mean, because I remember being a kid. I didn't go into that on my own. But I remember you have it's a discovery.
Yeah.
You're like looking down there. You're trying to figure
yeah,
it all
yeah,
out.
Yeah, completely.
Your body has a stimulus reaction.
Yeah.
I think that part of that's... The discovery part is kind of healthy, I think, as far as like the curiosity.
Absolutely.
Where
yeah.
it can go, possibly unhealthy, but the,
you know, you're
but the,
right.
But the it's natural, I think, for kids.
There's
to
an
go.
Innocent sort of you know, curiosity, mm-hmm. but if it gets interfered with, I think it can sort of lead to you compensate love. You think of love as that. Mm-hmm. So when I didn't have my father around, but I had somebody who was kind of molesting me, I thought that was love. So
right,
I would be
right.
like thinking, well, this is what I need to do to get men's attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because my father doesn't want me. So this guy who is doing these things to me must love me. Mm. So it gets a bit messed up. But now that I'm older, I'm grown up, I have really, you know, sort of analyzed it. And I realize a lot mm-hmm. of stuff about myself and where mm-hmm. it comes from and, you know, why
right.
and so
yeah.
on, you know.
So you think that did awaken the sexuality in you at an early age, right?
In a twisted way.
Right, obviously, yeah.
In a very twisted way, because I started to fantasize about soldiers as a 5 or 6 year old.
Wow.
And I didn't have really any male figures in my life, apart from really bad influences like the molesters mm-hmm. and soldiers who raided the streets, raided homes for anti-Shah literature and things like that. So every impression of male as a child to me was either a molester or soldiers and Shah's secret police.
Yeah.
I didn't really have a positive sort of male figure
right.
to look up to and think that men. So it was always a bit weird and twisted.
Right, yeah.
You know, as a child.
Yeah. So
that makes sense, though. I relate. I totally get it. They say that one of the hardest things with sexual... I want to say, I don't know, immorality is the right word, but like predator type stuff is that it's very confusing to kids and even whatever
yeah.
whatever age, because your body has its independent reaction physically.
Right.
But
right.
then emotionally, mentally, something, it
yeah,
screws
yeah, yeah.
with you. So there's a lot
yeah.
of shame.
Yeah, completely.
Because
yeah,
your body responds.
Because as a kid, you're going, this feels good. But then emotionally, mentally, you're going, wait a minute, this
no,
is not
you
right.
You think you are participating. You're equal to that person.
Yeah, and you're not.
You think you're a bad girl. Nor you don't think... someone's doing something bad, you think I am to blame
because you felt
I've instigated this reaction from this man.
It brings right. a lot of shame that
massive.
Which is, it shouldn't be there, but it is
massive
and it
shame.
Keeps people yeah. quiet from sharing what happens.
Yeah,
and, you know, it really does
completely.
So
yeah.
the molestation was probably people that you knew, right?
It was, you know what, it was neighbors, and you know what the weird thing is, that some of them used to teach me the Quran as well, and they used to
really?
Make me pray with them. So
yeah.
I had like the Quran readings and then, you know, sort of sexual abuse, which mm-hmm. was really messed up. The religion
right.
and sex were a big part of my childhood.
Right.
So I had to say my prayers every day, pray to God to keep me good and stuff. And then I had that happening. So
yeah.
you can imagine.
It happens in a lot of religions. I mean, it happens.
Oh, Catholicism.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
I mean,
look with all the priests.
Yeah,
you know,
the
and
priests.
Stuff,
I have
know.
A good friend of mine who was heavily abused sexually at a very young age. I mean, graphic stuff
wow.
by her stepdad who taught Sunday school.
Oh,
I mean,
my gosh.
And, I mean, do you know the kind of like, oh, in your stomach when you hear stuff like that? Because I just really believe that like God is about the spirit. And I mean, that stuff makes me emotional. Like, I'm already thinking about it. I'm like, oh, it makes me sad. But, and I think about like, just how confusing that is to people, you know what I mean? Because,
yeah.
Because it's just such a conflict, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Really,
I think if anybody would read the book, would think, well, because of all my experiences with rock stars and the rock and roll world, they think, well, is it because of her upbringing? Is it because mm-hmm. she's sort of confused sexuality? I don't know. I can't answer. I mean, a lot of I'm very sexual. I'm in control and power, and I say mm-hmm. what I like to do. Mm. I never do anything that I don't want to do.
Yeah. So you chose not to remain a victim, but
absolutely.
Actually, yeah.
Not
yeah.
at all. No, I don't feel like that at
yeah,
all.
Yeah. So, okay, well, we're talking to Roxana Shirazi, for those of you just joining us, and she wrote the book called The Last Living Slut, Born in Iran, Bred Backstage. And, well, obviously a great title, and people want to know more about this. So, tell us a little bit. So, your teenage years, what
right.
were those like?
I ran away from home when I was about 14. Mm-hmm. I was in a... Well, my stepfather was quite violent, and... actually, I'm supposed to talk about it. My stepdad was quite violent, and you know, I was getting beat up a lot.
Mm.
And it was a very taboo subject in our family, talk about domestic violence.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's an Iranian thing or if it was just our family, but it wasn't nice. And my mom never told anybody that, you know, about this. And
yeah.
when I wrote this, my mom doesn't even know that I've written about my stepdad hitting me, and he doesn't know that I've written about it. So I'm a bit worried about that.
Do you just want to send him like an autographed copy?
I know what.
And highlight some pages. I would just go big or go home,
I'm
girl.
I'm scared.
Yeah. I don't think that'd be the only part of the book they'd be concerned with. I'm sure if they read the whole book, they wouldn't be happy about it.
I guess so. My parents aren't religious.
Right.
They're not. My mom was quite liberal. Mm. My parents were quite left wing. So, you know, they just kind of like, as long as I'm in control and happy with what I do, that's fine. It's not like they're not sort of, you know, they'd rather if I pose naked, for example, it'd be for a very arty black and white publication than if I do anything trashy, you know?
Yeah. So going to the domestic abuse, what age did that start?
I was about 13, 14. So I ran away from home. I was about 15.
Yeah. And where did you go?
First I went to stay with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stayed there for a while, and then I went back home for a bit, but I kind of had enough of how it was at home. So I went to London and I started stripping. Mm. I was underage as well. Never
really?
Asked for my ID.
Really?
Yeah.
And you were what, 17?
I was about 16, 17. Yeah.
Right.
So I was at college, like, I don't know what you call it here. College is like when you go somewhere from the age of 16 to 18.
Oh.
And I started it, but I was leading a double life in a way, because I was sort of studying but going to London at weekends to do, like, be naughty.
Right. Now, how did you get into the stripping? Was there someone waiting by the bus stop when you got there?
And I got into London, and I was kind of like, ooh, I'm in London, the big city. And I'd had enough of being at home, and I remember just going to Soho, which is like a really cool place in London. It's like got all the strip clubs, and it's very arty, it's very bohemian and everything. So and then I saw a sign, and they were looking for girls, and I just went. It was called the Sunset Strip in Soho.
Yeah.
And I went in there, and they didn't even ask for my ID, and then they said, when can you start? So I did a couple of shows.
What was your first experience like? I mean, were you nervous?
Terrifying.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Terrifying. It was quite young. And all these girls are much older than me, and they were talking about their kids and talking about everything.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what to wear, so I wore my school uniform.
Which
was even worse.
Yeah,
I know. I didn't even
that.
Think of it like that. So I went in there, and I just started, like, working, earning a bit of extra money. And nobody ever knew about this, by the way.
Yeah.
Nobody.
I'm sure.
Wait a
I'm
second.
Sure.
Nobody as in,
so you
like,
were, like, on your own with your own
family
secret.
Never knew about it.
Never, ever, ever.
During
ever.
The stripping, were you still living with your family?
I used to go home, you know, weekdays to go to college. I was at college studying.
Yeah, okay.
I was doing drama and acting. And then on weekends, I would go, not every weekend, but, you know, as much as I could possibly, to go to London
mm-hmm.
and do it. So,
yeah.
And I used to say I'm staying with friends or whatever.
And were you making a lot of cash doing
that? Not a lot. I wasn't that good. I wasn't
what
great.
Did you,
I was quite shy.
Okay. What did you find out that made it, what made the girls great at it? Was it because they were doing other stuff as well, or?
I don't know. I think they were just more confident. I was quite a nerdy girl. I just think it was an escapism for me to just get away from home and do something as a rebellion.
Right,
really.
Right.
Something completely that, you know, would be against my parents wanting me to do. They wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor.
Right.
You know, so, and I was just doing something for the hell of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just quite shy, and I was scared, and the other girls could talk to the guys, and I was like, I can't talk to anybody.
Yeah. How long were you doing that? Stripping?
I started like that when I was 16, so I'd say about a couple of years, but then I moved on to doing belly dancing, which was with clothes. So, right, you know, there wasn't stripping. Yeah. So I was a bit more confident. I was doing belly dancing in Arabic clubs, underground sort of Arabic clubs, which were just men. And I would go with a few friends and we would dance our Arabic dancing and belly dancing, very tantalizing and teasing. And then then I got made good money from that because, you know, they loved that I was Iranian and, you know, they sort of, they knew I was studying. So it helped with my studies quite a lot.
And did you enjoy the belly dancing?
I didn't. Yeah, that was fun because, you know, I was with my friends and they were all either Iranian or Pakistani or Indian and stuff. So I kind of felt safe with them. And then, you know, it was a bit nicer than the stripping, definitely. And I loved the costumes because they were so,
they're so pretty.
Gorgeous.
They're really pretty. I was in Houston and I saw these girls. These girls went to town and they, I want to do, I just want to do it too, just because I like the outfits. But they have like glitter everywhere and they're like, ding, 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 and they're just like freaking shaking it and there's bells everywhere.
Yeah.
I was so jealous.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
So jealous. I wanted to borrow their outfits.
So now the strip bar, was that like topless or fully nude?
Fully nude.
Fully nude.
Oh, yeah,
wow, that took a lot from you.
God, I don't know how I did it.
At 16, I'm like sitting, because I was kind of out there too, not like that at 16, but I had a very big personality, but I wasn't like comfortable, you know, even with cleavage.
But I wasn't. I have to say, I lost my virginity when I was 24, so I hadn't even kissed a boy until I was 24. So I wasn't like that. I was just doing it like a rebellion. Thing.
Right, right. It was more of a job. I mean, you didn't really think of it.
I didn't think, oh, I feel so good. You know, in a way, I did sometimes because I would take my picture of Axl Rose with me because he was the one who always turned me on. And then I would be like, I would get the guts to go out there and do it because you know, I really loved Axl Rose. So, you know, but you know, I was never into the boy. I was too shy to be with boys. So I didn't even kiss a boy until I was 24 years old.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, but guys were probably, you know, making passes at you and stuff,
right? Yeah, of course.
So what happened? You were just afraid to get attached? Or,
I wanted to be with someone who I was in love with and I would get married with and settle down. I would be my only one.
Right.
The only guy I'd be with. And I had a really romanticized view of everything, you know, in that way. I didn't want to just sleep with anyone. It had to be the one I was in love with and we'd settle down. And so I waited and then waited and I waited. Yeah. And I had had experiences with girls.
Oh, you have?
Before guys.
Right.
But
what age? Like late teens? 15,
16.
15, 16.
Yeah.
Curiosity?
Just, they turned me on.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And how did you discover that? I mean, you just hang out with them and you felt that you were attracted to them?
Yeah. I always remember being attracted to girls from a young age. And I remember once just, there was a girl who was kind of a friend and we went to the same school. And then one night we were just sitting in my place and just watching TV and it kind of started off from there. It wasn't anything that I planned. It was just spontaneous.
Was it the same feeling as like if you're with a man and there's like romance or was it more just like...
No, it wasn't romance.
Like okay. It's just more like, let's try this.
It was a raw animal sexuality.
Right.
And it felt really good. But I did want it to, kind of like a preparation for being with a guy because I want to just explore the sexuality and kind of, you know.
Well, I mean, I've shared that I've made out with girls when I was like 13 and stuff, but it wasn't like, wasn't romantic. It wasn't like I ever wanted to be with a woman. In fact, it made me realize I'll never be gay because I just can't get down. I can't get down with that. I'm just not going to lie. Yeah. But it's like a safety. It was women you feel safe with and you're a girl and you're kind of like, oh, well, I don't know how all this worked. And you want to know how your parts work and you kind of you want to know what some of the feelings feel like.
Yeah.
And I felt safe with girls and I was the same way. I was very like nervous with guys. Mm-hmm. So it was never like, oh, I'm ever going to be interested in girls. Although... It sounds there's a
right.
Fly.
Yeah, there's a little fly here.
But anyway, my point is I kind of relate in that sense, like, you know, making out with this girl and we're Facebook friends and it's like where we're like 13, I think we're junior high or something, 13 or 14. And I'm like, I wonder if she's ever told anybody. Not that I give a shit now, but
I'm sure lots of girls.
I think so.
So I mean, but you repeated that, right? With different girls?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm very comfortable with girls. I'm very into girls. And I've never had a full-on relationship with one.
Right. But sexually, you're very compatible.
Yeah, completely.
Wow.
Yeah. Sam is loving this. Everybody at home is like, tell me more. Don't stop.
Playing with myself under the desk. But so then at 24, you met someone?
Yes. I was working in a Greek restaurant, and I met the son of the owner.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, wow, you know, he's great and lovely and everything. And then he was a, you know, really big womanizer and whatever. But,
oh, man.
And so it happened.
But, yeah, you didn't mind it. You were attracted to that.
I know. I felt good. I felt safe with him. I felt right. Okay. I thought he was nice and romantic and everything. Uh-huh. And it happened. And it wasn't a nice experience, my
friend.
Right. First time.
Usually the first one is not that great.
You know, it was very painful and bled really? Everywhere.
Wow. Yeah, that's not a good
time,
memory.
The first
huh?
time kind of sucks.
It was horrible.
Yeah, yeah, the first time kind of sucks.
Yeah, yeah, it sucks. It sucks.
Wow.
Yeah, guys have it so easy. They don't have to go through it. They just put it in.
I know,
you know,
that's
just put it.
It
in. And maybe theirs is like, yeah, my first time, it happened too quick, is usually what they're like.
Exactly. And most guys are like, oh, I lost my virginity when I was like 12, man, to the babysitter. And, yeah. You know, and they're all right with saying that. Can you imagine if a woman says, I lost my virginity when I was 12?
Uh-huh.
It's really different the way
it
people
really
look
is.
At women and yeah. men, sexuality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's really why, weird. You know, when you see those female teachers abusing those
yeah.
those kids,
yeah.
you know, people are saying, you know, there's no abuse there. The kid probably
right.
loves it, you know. But
yeah.
The bottom
but
line
it's got to be consensual.
Exactly.
I mean, it can't be. That's violence
exactly.
if it's not consensual. It's
yep.
not sex. It's
well, they're saying it's yeah. consensual, but the thing is that it, can a 12-year-old
yeah.
understand
cannot,
what they're doing? No.
Yeah.
I mean,
not
cannot,
really.
They can't understand. They can't understand what they're – I mean, I would think that you know, they say that the long-term part of the brain – the part of the brain that can make long-term decisions to understand the effects doesn't even fully develop until, like, the early 20s.
Right.
So to okay. think about people, you know, having sexual relationships or things like that
right. –
prior to that, even though they may say it's consensual, they don't mm-hmm. even understand what they're doing.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have the emotional capacity.
No, they don't,
to
they
really
don't understand.
Yeah.
To,
yeah.
Right. So now after that, at one point in your life, you became a groupie, right?
I did. I'm too wild to be a groupie, I have to say. I'm
really?
Way too wild for it. There's too many rules and it's too limiting for me.
Really?
So what?
But how did this start? I mean, you start.
Yeah.
What, did you one day say to yourself, I want to hang out with these rockers?
No, I didn't. I was never into that at all.
Really?
I was never, ever into it. I thought the rock world was like dirty and gross and
uh-huh.
horrible, you know?
Yeah.
And then one night, it was just a very big coincidence. I had a friend who managed a very big band called Stereophonics.
Okay. Oh, I love Stereophonics,
band.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the members, you know, the drummer was staying at his house that night, and I was staying there as well. So I kind of hung out with him, and he was wild, and he was, like, cool, and he was such a free spirit like me. And I thought, uh-huh. if all musicians are such free spirits and such, like, you know, anything goes, I'm like, well, it'd be a good match. So after, like, being with him, I went to a lot of gigs, I got backstage, and then it just went on from there, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And so obviously this involved... Okay, so tell us, what does it mean? I mean, did you, like, meet those people and then follow them, or...?
Initially, at the very beginning, I would go and just get backstage.
Yeah.
And then I would meet them. So next time they were in town, they would, like, keep in touch and say, come, I'm in town, so come out, you know.
Really?
So, like, there were certain bands I didn't have any connections with like, Avenged Sevenfold.
Right.
And I just went backstage and I went, I'm here for the band. And
really?
The security were like, who are you? I said, I'm the band entertainment. Let me in. And they were like, okay. And I'd go in and I would just march up there and be like, hi, guys.
Really?
You know?
So they all got to know you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know.
In more ways than one, I'm sure. So
yeah.
You,
if,
you,
I ha- if I was attracted to them, I would have to be really attracted to them. You know?
I see. So it wasn't with everyone.
No. Some of them I found really ugly. So,
yeah,
know,
really?
I didn't. You know?
So you just, I mean, what were some of your favorite bands that you got to hang out with?
Brides of Destruction, who are like Nikki Sixx's old band. He had like a side band,
mm-hmm.
not Motley Crue. And, you know, and everyone always says it's to do with fame and stuff, but certain bands are not famous at all, and they're the most fun in the world,
really,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's not to do with them. I've met some really famous rock stars, and they've been so dull.
Like
you know?
Who can you name?
No.
You can't tell us.
Well, but there are some in the book, though, right?
But there are some in the book.
Members of Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue.
Mm. Well, I mean, I went on tour with Whitesnake and Def Leppard, and I was dull, man.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah. But you know what? They've been there, done it in the 80s. I don't think they
exactly.
feel the need to do anything now. They're all married and settled down.
Yeah,
so
and older
not like, yeah.
and stuff like that.
I mean, Buck Cherry was such fun. You know, I had a lot of fun with Buck Cherry.
Really?
You know, some. You know, I did fall in love a couple of times.
Oh, you did?
That was pretty bad of me to do that. But it's like, you know, it's a four-letter word.
Uh-huh.
In rock and roll, love is a dirty word. You know,
yeah.
you just don't do it. And I, you know, I couldn't. I'm such a romantic person, and I was just full of, like, love for these guys. And,
uh-huh.
you know, a couple of them I felt really I fell heavily in love with. So it was just my downfall, really.
So yeah. Do you relate to the movie Almost Famous?
Yeah, I do. I do a lot. You know, I had actually a friend, Laurie, in the book. She was like my sister, my soulmate. She is Penny Lane. You know, she has such similarities, and it was just weird. It was like being in the film.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we went everywhere together on tour and stuff. Mm. So I do relate to it. I think that the difference is that the girl in that, she's in her teens, she's 15, 16, and I was much older, and I don't think I could have done it if I had been that age.
Yeah.
I couldn't have handled it, because now I felt much more in control. Like, if some band guys went up to having sex with me, I'd go, well, go out there and find me an American rocker, you know? I would tell them to go and find me someone to have fun with, you know? So I was the one that was always telling them, you know, do this, do that, experiment with this, and they were all like, okay, I'll do it, you know?
Yeah. So your book is titled, what, The Last Living Slut.
Yeah.
Bread backstage, I think it's funny. It's just so, I love the how it's so contradictory, like the front cover.
Right.
It's just,
yeah.
It's got a picture of her with the, as a child. It's so pretty. I mean, you know, your face is really beautiful, obviously, that you're covered up, but as an Iranian picture, black and white, right, with all these like hot pink stickers and like band stuff. And I mean, I see what you're going for. Like, what, how has it been received as far as, I mean, your friends or family? And
I've have been getting such lovely emails from people. I'm so I feel really humbled. I'm like, not, you know, it's so nice, you know. And people from all over the world have been sending me really lovely emails, and they've read about kind of what this is about and my life and things like. They think I'm really brave. There's some Iranians that say, you know, be careful because they don't want me to get killed, beheaded, or whatever. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you that. I mean, is that true? Is this one of these things that, because I've just heard that it, you know, and I mean, the U.S. is further away.
Yeah,
but it
I
still
know.
Can be penetrated. I'm talking like more like in Europe and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, is something you have to watch your back if you come out and open?
I don't know. I'm a bit, I mean, I don't insult the Quran, I don't insult Islam, and I don't insult the Prophet Muhammad in my book at all.
Right.
So they have no reason to sort of say.
But sometimes that stuff's irrational. It's just because, look at you.
Well, they're
always
volatile.
Irrational. Yeah.
Sometimes that those fanatics, it's not about what makes sense.
Well, if something does happen, then I would want the whole world to know, because why isn't there freedom to do things you want to do?
Yeah.
I would want, I mean, there is nothing that no one can do about this. You know, the Islamic governments kill journalists all the time. They kill artists. They kill photographers.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sit by and let it happen. I mean, why is this happening now? You know, it just makes me so angry. Like, no, freedom of speech to me is the most scariest thing. I mean, you need to have freedom of speech to express what you want to say and do.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that in Iran, if they find it so offensive that I've written a book about my life that they feel the need to kill me, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Shouldn't
yeah.
someone do something?
No,
about
I wouldn't it? Worry about it. They've got bigger things to worry about.
I hope
about.
So. I really hope so.
Wow.
So how did the book come about? I mean, at what point did you decide, I have an interesting life, let me put it on paper?
Well, I was at university and I was writing about my life in Iran. I was writing a political satire about Islam, which I would never publish.
Yeah. But,
and I was writing about all the... I studied gender and feminism, so I was writing about sort of deconstructing gender stereotypes, you know, and I speak at conferences, like women's conferences, about this. So it started off as a thing about my childhood in Iran and kind of a sort of something about my sense of self as a child. And then at the time I was going to see a lot of bands and stuff. Someone said, why don't you put that in as well? That'd be quite interesting, your two lives.
Yeah. Mm.
So I was like, well, I don't know, it's quite racy, the stuff I get up to.
Yeah.
Should I really, really put this? And my tutor was like, don't censor yourself. You know, if it's quite whatever you do sexually, just write everything.
Yeah.
And then so I put them together, and then you know, and then it just came about, and then I met Neil Strauss, and I showed him my manuscript, and he really loved it. And
really?
The thing was, at the beginning, no one wanted to publish it. They were like, it's too controversial, it's too racy, we can't publish this. And then eventually HarperCollins, you know,
picked
up on it.
So Neil Strauss is an author about himself.
Yes.
I mean, he wrote the book Emergency, I think, and we had him on the show about a year ago or so. And so he's a publisher too?
He's got this new publishing group called Igniter Publishing Group. Him and Anthony Bozo, who Anthony Bozo wrote Slash's book, and he's wrote Tommy Land about Tommy Lee's book.
Uh-huh.
And so they started this publishing group called Igniter, and this is the first book that's come out.
Nice.
It's in collaboration with HarperCollins.
Uh-huh.
You know,
okay, so you do have the blessing of a large publisher.
I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
To, you know,
yeah.
That they took it on.
So what did you do? You had to find an agent, right?
Yes. I mean, I found an agent.
Oh, do you have to have different ones in Europe and then one in the United States?
Well, no, I have one in Europe, uh-huh. but I have like publicists in London, LA, and New York. So yeah. It's a bit all over the place at the moment. And the agent, obviously, I did everything myself. I found the kind of the connections to publish it myself.
Right.
The agent
good
just.
For you. And you wrote it yourself too, no ghostwriter.
Yeah, completely. No. I've been writing. My first book was when I was 14. I wrote about the street kids of Sao Paulo. So uh-huh. I've been writing poetry and political stuff and academic stuff since I was really young. So I always loved to write.
Mm. Yeah. So you've had a lot of talents other than going to bed with rockers and stuff like that.
I hope so.
No, you seem like a very layered, complicated woman.
Yeah,
I think that's,
and very intelligent.
Man, I'm gonna butcher this. This is a fabulous quote by a fabulous person of who I can't remember, and I'm butchering the quote. But it's pretty amazing, and it's in light of, even in light of God, it says that, you know, a woman should be, she should be completely, man, it's talking about that she should be fully alive, passionate, humble, and extremely provocative.
Wow.
In a way, and not just talking about her looks, but her spirit. Like a woman is made to, a woman is so influential in so many ways.
Yeah.
And that in like really bringing a spirituality context to it, that women are supposed to kind of have this duality in a way.
Well, of course, this is why I hate stereotypes. And, you know, going back to the parallels between an Islamic society and a Western culture, you know, I don't like that women have to, in Western society, have to adhere to this idea of beauty, be a certain weight, be certain this and that, constant pressure to be this model of beauty. And that's a kind of oppression in itself, because women, a woman is a woman. Why do they have to all look with big fake tits and, you know, this and that and that? Why, you know, this is, you know, what I don't like. So, you know, I think human beings are all complex. And, you know, sometimes in this society, we tend to stereotype them and put them into a category, which is like really not very good.
It goes to a completely different level in LA. And you don't realize it till like, I mean, you realize it living here, and you kind of get used to the pressure, and you kind of live with that tension, and you have to figure out what you're going to do, or either live for it or live counterculturally. But then you have friends that come visit that haven't been in the world, and they'll go, "This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous." You're like, what's ridiculous? What do you mean? What?
Yeah, I know.
And you're like, "Oh no, it's fun. It's flashy." And they're like, "No, this is ridiculous." I'm like, "Tell me about it, because I forgot that this is deranged." You know, because you live in it.
Yeah.
I've had friends visit. They're like, "I could never live here," and because of these societal pressures. You're kind of going, "What are you talking about?"
I know.
Because you've been in it so long. Right. The billboards, the people that you see, the conversations that are being had, you know, the constant inundating with the advertising.
Yeah.
Everybody that's just going to the grocery store and the way they're dressed. I mean, it becomes normal.
Yeah, it's like, what makes a human being? Is it just the outer, how they look? Because you have so many qualities as human beings. And as from living in Europe, when I come here, I see the difference. Because in Europe, it's like slightly, you know, it's not as superficial.
Oh, no. I mean, no, New York isn't as superficial. I mean, Texas isn't as superficial. I mean, in some ways. I mean, it's like there's a lot. I mean, L.A. is its own monster. Yeah. And it's fabulous. I love it. But at the same time, you have to watch that you don't drink the Kool-Aid too much. But this is where they generate movie stars. This is where the celebutante is built. This is where your celebrities are. This is where everything you see on TV that people like to escape to, they live here.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you've got to realize that in and of itself is really jacked up.
I know, it is.
The thing you turn on to escape and go, ha, 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 guess what? This is where they live and get their lattes and shop.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not just here, but, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't that
funny?
The
center of it. Yeah.
It's crazy, man. Oh, my gosh. So I'm excited to read your book. It just seems really, really provocative and interesting. And what is your next step right now? Are you doing book tours, things like that? Or
yeah, I've been doing a lot of interviews. I have a book signing tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
At the Rainbow on Sunset Strip in LA.
Awesome.
That's cool.
From 6 p.m. to 8, and then there's an after party.
Oh, really?
So,
at the Rainbow?
Yeah, I'll be speaking, doing question and answers, signing books.
Awesome.
And Neil Strauss will be there as well to answer questions.
Wow, we should try and make it.
And you guys
that's
should
tomorrow?
Come. Everybody's invited who's listening.
Yeah. Definitely.
So
you guys
time?
Should definitely meet Roxana. A lot of fun. And so where are you now in your life? Are you in a relationship right
now?
Yeah,
I am.
Are you?
Yes.
Have you been married at all in your
life? No, I don't really believe in marriage.
Right, yeah. Well, it's not like you saw a great example when you grew up.
Absolutely,
you know, of marriage and stuff, you know. So it's cool. How long have you been together?
I'd say a year and a half.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
So that's pretty serious.
Is he in Europe right now? Or?
He is in Europe, yeah. He's
oh,
in
okay.
Europe right now.
Is he a rocker?
No, he's not.
Yeah.
No.
She's like,
so, rockers are for fun, and that's it. You have a bit of fun, and then you leave them, and then you go to your real boyfriend.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But is he a cool guy?
He is very cool, and you know, I don't believe in monogamy. I think that if you love someone and you're their queen and you know they're your king, you should just let people to have their freedom.
Yeah. So Monique, I think Monique has the same view on that.
Oh,
right?
Really?
Yeah, she came out about how her marriage is an open marriage.
Wow, good for her.
I think winning the Oscar. Everyone was like, what?
Wow, good one.
Yeah.
So she came out with that, and it was very controversial. Cool. I think even Oprah, or no, Barbara Walters, somebody interviewed her about it. Mm. Anyway, but back to you. So you guys have an open relationship.
Yeah.
Okay.
And really? Wow, that's amazing. And it's working out, huh?
It's absolutely brilliant because you get to love that person so much more. Because as long as you're number one and you're the queen, they worship you and you absolutely love each other and then you're honest and you talk about it. And you're like so loving to each other.
Yeah.
Because you know if you can have the best sex, and then if you say you want variety.
Yeah.
Because human beings want. This is why there's affairs and stuff. It shouldn't be an affair. It should be you talk about it. I mean, not everybody will agree with me, obviously.
Yeah.
Totally.
No, I mean I would, but.
I love you, girl, but no, I can't get that.
I want to try that.
I'm very open. Yeah. He's way for it. I'm way against it. But, okay. But you know, I respect people's differences. But I can't buy it, but. But Sam sure as hell would.
I would.
In a heartbeat.
Okay, Roxana Shirazi, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
You're a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Everybody go out and get the book, The Last Living Slut, Born in Iran, Bred Backstage. And the book just came out, right?
It came out yesterday in bookshops.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Wow, it's awesome. Very great. I can't wait to read. It looks good.
And very courageous, I think, to write a book like
Thank you.
Awesome. So good luck to you, everybody.
Tomorrow,
the book signing 6 to 8 at the Rainbow on Sunset Boulevard.
Yep.
And
after party. So come and have fun. Dance.
Yeah, there you go. After party. All right. So thank you all for joining us. Kira, thank you.
I hope
tomorrow you're not bringing that hat with you again.
I'm going to.
It's disgusting.
You know what? I'm going to package it up with a bow.
All right. We'll see you all tomorrow.
You have been listening to Sam and Kara in the Morning, which airs every weekday from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, originating from the Los Angeles Talk Radio studios. If you have questions about the show or would like to inquire about sponsorship opportunities, please direct all correspondence to info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Kara in the Morning is a production of LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.